A community that knows itself takes care of itself. The stories of those who live in the Matsu Borough are as varied as the people themselves. Some you have heard. Some, perhaps, you have not. This is Voices of the Matsu, bringing our stories to life.
I'm Emily Forstner, your host today. We usually talk about community on this program and the smaller groups found within it, but today we're going to focus on a tough topic that impacts our community: domestic violence in the Matsu. We call this episode The Final Straw. It's a painful reality for many and one that is often kept a secret. Just a heads up, these stories might be triggering, as domestic violence is all too common. The UAA Justice Center has conducted the Alaska Victimization Survey since 2010. It finds in Alaska, 48%. That's almost one in two women will experience personal harm. But in the Matsu, it's even more, 53%, one in two. So this could even be your story, or the story of someone you love. First, we hear from a successful businesswoman who shares how she came to be in an abusive marriage, how she left and started again. Then in Act Two, another professional shares her story, but with a broader stroke, about the mechanisms at work in violent and toxic relationships. Both stories are about hitting that breaking point, their final straw, and finding the strength to take back their lives in and with community.
I will tell you, and they call it the straw that broke the camel's back. It wasn't domestic violence. My 40th birthday was coming, and my ex said he wanted to make it special. And he went away to go purchase special things for my birthday. We lived in a small little community called Neustoyahawk, Alaska. So he was going to ride the snow machine to Dillingham to purchase me stuff for my birthday. I didn't see or hear from him for 2 days. He walked in the door and handed me a bag of dried mangoes. And that was it. I was done.
Surprised? Keep listening.
We had one airline that flew out to our little village, and I called them. I said, "Do you have a plane today?" And they said, "We do." And I said, "Do you have a seat available?" And they said, "We have one left." I said, "I want it." I packed a backpack of clothes, and I never looked back.
Where do you go when you take the last plane out of town? For Tamara, now Tamara Ziegler, she flew to Palmer, Alaska. She came home.
My parents moved me out to Palmer when I was 9 years old from Anchorage. I graduated from Burchell High School.
You may know Tamara as the owner of Misfit Consignment on Alaska Street in downtown Palmer.
It will be 8 years in January.
In domestic violence, substance abuse often plays a part.
He is an alcoholic and a drug addict, back then and currently. Oh, I tried counseling. I did Al-Anon. I went to a lot of AA meetings with him. I found that those helped me a lot. Most of the time, I just buried my head and became a mom and took care of the kids, took care of the house. It just gradually started happening, and it got worse and worse as the years went by. The straw that broke my camel's back wasn't domestic violence, but there was continued domestic violence for 25 years. There was emotional, there was physical, there was all of the above. There was black eyes, there was bruises, there was choking, there was shoving, there was being pushed out of a car, there was being pushed out of doors, there was being tackled and a broken knee, there was hair pulling, there was a lot. Kids witnessed a lot. It started before we even got married. And don't ask me why I got married. I thought that I was in love and he was it. And no, he was not. And that was not love. I know what love is now.
The cycle of violence continues because you believe it won't.
It was always after it happened. He was so sorry it would never happen again. He loved me. He couldn't live without me. Would pull on my heartstrings. And I want to believe in him and want to believe that it would never happen again. And inevitably it would. I never thought I deserved it. I never thought I was part of the problem. But I did the best I could, given the situation I was in.
It's all about control and power. And it's really hard to see at first, but there are almost always signs when you look back.
Absolutely, from the very get-go. My mom raised me, like I raised my children, to be leaders, not be followers, be myself. And he didn't want me to be myself and didn't like my friends and didn't want me to hang out with my friends, didn't trust me at all. Very soon after we got together, we had went on a drive with one of his very best friends, and both of the gentlemen got out of the vehicle to use the restroom. The friend got back in the vehicle with me, and we didn't know where my boyfriend was. And finally the friend says, "He's watching us." And I said, "What?" "He is behind the tree over there, watching us." And I looked out of the corner of my eye and I spotted him. And so I knew in the very beginning that it was a little odd, a little different.
Statistically, it takes an average of 7 times to leave an abusive relationship for good.
Yes. And I had left probably 30 times before that. At one point, my ex and I lived in Florida, and my mom got me out of there, brought me back home. At one point, I left and was in the women's shelter. Numerous times, I left and would stay at friends' houses, or my mom's house, or my grandma's house. But again, it was always, "I love you, I can't live without you, I'll do better, I'll never do it again." And I'd say, "Okay." They were all so disappointed every single time. So disappointed in me. I was told repeatedly that I couldn't make it on my own. I couldn't make it without him. Nobody would ever want me with 4 children. Nobody would ever love me the way he does. I heard it all. So yes, my confidence was kicked down to the dirt. A few times my friends would drive to my house and say, "I just had to look at you. I just had to make sure you're okay. You won't answer your phone." Change is scary, but leaving, and even though it's not comfortable, it's still the comfort of your home, because that's your home, is scary. To go out into the absolute unknown, because even though a domestic violence home is not safe, it's still home. I was in the family for 25 years. I felt just like his dad was my dad. His grandma was my grandma. We had an unbreakable bond. I loved that woman so much. They hold a very special spot in my heart still to this day. They are my family. They loved me. They loved him. It was very hard for them. They, of course, knew that I needed to leave. Wanted me to leave, but also wanted me to be with him. It was a very hard situation for all of us. They all wanted me to leave. They all begged me for years to leave him. And when I finally did, every single one of them were so happy.
When Tamara took that last seat on the plane out of town, she was alone. And here's where her story resonates with me so much. She didn't stay alone. She landed into open arms.
My oldest daughter was married and living in a mother-in-law apartment at her mother and father-in-law's house, and they had room for myself. So I lived with them. They were very gracious, very wonderful. My children came 1 to 2 weeks later. They let them stay also. So I left with a backpack of clothes, not a penny to my name, no car, no job, no nothing, horrible credit, nothing. So I found myself a full-time job, got myself part-time jobs.
But she needed a car. So her ex-father-in-law loaned her $2,000 for a down payment, and her dad co-signed on a loan, and she was able to get, at 40 years old, a car. She started over. And her ex-husband's grandmother rented her a house right in downtown Palmer.
It was magical. It was wonderful. It was, if you ask any of my children, it was the absolute best times of all of our lives. When I first left him, I didn't know who I was. For 25 years, I had been his wife, the girl's mom. I had lost Tamara. So I had to figure out what kind of TV shows I liked, what kind of movies I liked to watch, what kind of music I listened to, what kind of food I liked to eat. Because it was all about him and my children.
Make no mistake, though, this is easier said than done.
I had to have courage to get a job, to ask for help to get the car, to get the house, to open my own shop. Courage every day to go to work. A lot of courage to speak to people at my shop. For 25 years, I was never heard. I didn't speak very much. My feelings didn't matter. My thoughts didn't matter. My words didn't matter. Not anymore.
There are some warning signs, or what are called red flags.
Big red flag. Not wanting you to hang out with your friends. Not wanting you to take part in family functions. To help family members.
Tamara suggests that the best offense is a strong defense.
Be true to themselves. Number one, absolutely no physical violence. No. No verbal. Nothing. And number two, do not let them get into your head.
And if all else fails,
basically get out. Get your backpack.
It's the final straw. Abusive relationships don't all look alike. They're easy to keep secret. Tamara says to break the cycle, the first step, though, is not to keep that secret anymore.
Talk to a friend. Seek a counselor. Find a family member. Talk about your situation. Because in talking about your situation, sometimes it will ring a bell and it will make you see that what you're going through is not right. And it will possibly help you to get out. There are so many people out there willing, eager, able to help. At any time. I'm one of them.
I asked Tamara if she ever wondered just how far the violence might have escalated if she hadn't reached that final straw. Yes, she wondered, but not anymore.
I have a relationship where there is no verbal, there is no emotional, there is no physical, there is nothing. It is just 100% love and respect.
One word, I asked Tamara, just one word.
My one word is happiness. That is my one word. That was what I strived for 25 years and what I've had for the last 11.
You've been listening to Tamara Ziegler on Voices of the Mat Zoo, produced for Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Coming up next is Act 2 of our episode, Final Straw. We hear from another professional woman. You may notice similarities between the two stories, and in Act 2, hear greater reflections on how and why domestic violence and abuse is so difficult to contain.
While I was working full-time, it did not, up until it did, cross my mind to stand my ground on anything. And finally, I think my son was about 5 months old, and he disappeared again. And this time he took my dog. My name is Michelle Harmeling.
You may know Michelle as the Development Outreach Director for United Way of Mat Zoo.
So he took my dog. And I remember just sitting there seething. And I was just so angry. you know, and this is another emotion that people just think, you know, it's like, well, we've got to learn to forgive and forget. You know, anger is bad for us. But in my case, and I think that this is a strong message, anger is a catalyst for action. Like, do I think you should get angry and throw bricks through a window? No. Do I think that you should get angry and use it to remind yourself of who you are underneath the mess and who you should be and what you deserve, and then use that to get out of it? 100%.
It was, metaphorically, her bag of dried mangoes. It was the final straw.
He's walking up the stairs with my dog, trying to act like nothing ever happened. I said, I am throwing your stuff down on this lawn. Don't you dare come up here. And he looked at me, and I think in that moment, it was that he had never expected someone to ever stand up to him that way. And he turned around and he walked. It was actually my car that he was driving. And he didn't even take the car. He turned around and started walking, but he still had my dog. And so I flew down the stairs and I jumped in the car, and I think I was going probably 100 miles an hour. I was on the Glen Highway and pulled out of my driveway, cut him off. And I said, give me my dog back right now, you know what? And I put the dog in the car and I went back to the apartment. I locked the doors and I was done.
Michelle grew up in Mat-Su, graduated from Palmer High School, left to go to college, came back, and married a childhood friend.
By the time I reconnected with this person, it was, you know, I was 32 and I was lonely and I was tired of being lonely. And there are people in the world who are very, very good at capitalizing on that. It's like they can smell it. It sounds terrible because it sounds predatory, but it is terrible and it is predatory. It was blatantly obvious that this person was doing drugs in our mutually shared apartment and inviting unsavory characters over and kind of using it as a crash pad. I was the only one working. He would lie. Oh, I'm going to work. And he would take his little lunchbox and his little thermos and get in the car in the morning. Well, he wasn't going to work. Nobody really knew where he was going.
She's open about the drug use, but Michelle says that is not an excuse.
There are plenty of humans on the planet who struggle with depression, anxiety, mental illness. They do not ever lay their hands on another person. There's not an excuse.
Michelle doesn't identify with the label of survivor.
It's kind of disempowering. I'm an ultra runner. I'm a mom. I work in nonprofit for the good of the community. I'm a writer, you know. I like to pick mushrooms and I strongly prefer, you know, wine over beer.
She's got a great life. She has an amazing partner. He's got 3 kids, her bonus kids. Michelle says that the way we talk about domestic violence in conversation is part of the problem, that it's something done to someone. And she argues against that.
We talk about a lot about what's called imposter syndrome. It's the idea that the bad things that happen to us are who we are. This is our lot in life. This is what we were born into the world to experience. But I think when you talk about domestic violence, you are talking about perpetration. You're talking about someone doing something to you. And so that is what happened. And that's how I've always looked at it. Someone who is bent on perpetrating something like that more than likely is still going to do it. And it is not a thing that happens to you. You didn't do anything to deserve it.
She says the focus shouldn't be on why someone didn't leave sooner, but it should be on the abuser's actions and holding them accountable.
It's very difficult to feel that you have the ability to stand up to it or to call someone or to track down those resources or even to acknowledge that it's happening when the language being used is one that sort of removes the culpability from this person who's doing this thing to you. Someone is doing them and they shouldn't be doing them, and it is the wrong thing to do.
The definition for domestic violence and abuse includes a broad spectrum, but isolation and escalation, these come up time and time again.
Yeah, that is 100% what happened. Definitely a lot of kind of self-aggrandizement, very sort of, well, I'm better than all these other people and here's why you should not listen to anyone else and here's why I don't respect this other person. There was a lot of verbal abuse, and that is a lot of times where it starts. Lots of name calling, you know, and then very much on the flip side, lots of, I'm so sorry, whatever, when it was all over. Rather textbook.
And sometimes there's this weird Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde part of the story. It helps keep it secret.
Absolute dichotomy in demeanor publicly versus at home. Those are definitely, you know, that one person with other people and then someone else with you until possibly that, you know, that temper spills over or the, you know, the drinking occurs and the behavior changes then in public. And that was the case.
Have you ever heard someone tell you, well, you know, you only have yourself to blame? It's statements like that that can really motivate you to get going, or they keep you stuck.
That was the pivotal dark place, was that, you know, we did live together before we got married, and this person had been acting kind of off and verbally abusive and isolating, you know, and hating my friends and all these things for a while. And we got married anyway. So you give chances, you know, in tandem with this idea that you kind of signed up for it.
It becomes the reason to stay.
Being trapped in that kind of situation doesn't cause someone to call the troopers. It doesn't cause, you know, right away. It doesn't cause someone to call for help. They leave. They pack up and they leave and they say, oh, I'm going to stay at my parents. I'm going to go stay at my friends. And so I was doing that. And I was doing it while I was pregnant. And I was doing it with a newborn baby while I was working full time. It did not, up until it did, cross my mind to stand my ground on anything.
But Michelle is quite clear. That's not the point.
And I'm going to repeat myself again. You know, that still does not excuse what this person is doing.
Michelle thinks about it. And she points out that a major barrier to any intervention is independence.
I think both the respect that we have for it, the powerlessness that we have to take it away, which is as it should be, correct? And the emotional turmoil of being, you know, on the sidelines while somebody that you love is going through this. I mean, that's a powerful, you know, that's a powerful witch's brew right there. And I certainly don't blame anybody for not marching in. You know, I think that nobody knows what's going on unless you speak about it. And I will say I wasn't very actively speaking about it at all. Because one of the primary goals of these kinds of psychologies and these kinds of, you know, people that perpetrate domestic violence is that they're the center of attention. When that was no longer the case, you know, then everything else was, you know, I was able to pick it all back up and you know, juggle all the balls and do all the things and the garbage and the boulder kind of roll away and you just go, oh, okay, like I can climb this hill now. That's fine. That's what I was doing before.
That takes a lot of courage.
Bravery is typically a single act. It was very brave, I think, for me to chuck this guy's crap out on the lawn of my rental and give him the metaphorical and figurative finger and tell him never to come back. That was an act of bravery. But courage, to me, is defined as undergoing these very cumbersome and heavy repetitions to move one's life in the direction that it needs to go. And that's day after day and over and over and over, right? We talk about the courage of folks who are living with cancer, and that's getting up every single day and going to a treatment. It is not the bravery of, you know, pulling somebody out of a burning building. It is this extremely taxing and unglamorous routine. It's the routine of facing down the things that you could let kind of ruin your life. This is a thing that I have to wake up every day, and there's some kind of smidgy little reminder, right? And I don't get a choice. I have to leave my house. I have to go for a run. I have to, you know, feed the cats. I have to pack my kids lunch. Those are courageous things to do, in so much as they are very, very mundane things that you could let crush you when combined with the weight of what you've been through. Another big driver behind getting out of this is that I started waking up in the morning and mentally I was just like, I don't even know who I am anymore. This is ridiculous. You know, underneath it all is this, you know, I had stopped being courageous in those moments. I had stopped getting up every day and reminding myself who my parents are and reminding myself who my family is, reminding myself what I love and why I'm here and why I chose to come back to Palmer, right? Because I love it so. I was just quagmired in this idea that what this person was forcing me to, you know, to undergo was shifting my perception of myself. And then I finally just sat there, you know, on this couch, and I thought, you know, I hate this.
Changing the narrative away from hiding and diminishing the truth is probably the best way to get help.
it was not something that I did, I think, because I was just so completely overwhelmed and I was trying to work the pathway that I think is common, which is to start by calling my family first or calling his family first to talk him down or whatever. If this person is, you know, yelling and verbally berating you and slamming things around, call 911. Just do it, because one of the things that's going to help you get safe is to establish this pattern of behavior. And nobody knows that it's happening unless you tell them. And certainly, you know, your family is not equipped to handle somebody like that. You know, your best friend is probably not equipped to handle somebody like that.
One of Michelle's favorite quotes comes from ultra runner James Devon Yanko.
My transparency was born out of that moment where I had to wholly stand up for myself. No one else was around to help me. That's one of the truest statements I've ever heard, right? The more you tell the truth about something like this, about a situation like this, about a person like this, the less power it has over you. So talk.
One word, Michelle. Just one word. Okay, maybe two.
Well, I think when I think about that, I guess it's two words. You said I could have two words. And it's both the title of the story and the last message I would give, I think, to anybody who's kind of like going through this, is to live. You have to live. You must recognize that this is not you. It's not your fault. It's not your responsibility. It's not, you are not to blame. You deserve to live. And when it's over, you will continue to live. This is why we talked about the difference between calling people victims and survivors, is that you put that tag on it and that's all they feel like they can do and be. But that's not who you were before. You are here to live.
To live and to be happy. Don't we all deserve as much? Listeners wanting to know more or know of ways to support or seek help can call Alaska Family Services at 907-746-4080 or their 24-hour helpline at 907-746-8026. Or for help with divorce or custody cases, call Alaska Legal Services at 907-746-4636, as well as the local law enforcement through 911. And that's it for today's episode of Voices in the Mat-Su. If you have a story or know of someone who does, contact us at voices@bigcabbageradio.org. Until next time, it's been nice getting to know each other a little bit more. Special thanks to the Big Cabbage editorial board and sound editor Emma Keachley. Thanks for listening. Stay good out there, Mat-Su.
This was Voices of the Mat-Su, sharing stories told by those who live in the Mat-Su borough. To revisit this and past stories, go to bigcabbageradio.org. This project is funded by a grant from the Mat-Su Health Foundation and is produced by Emily Forstner for Big Cabbage Radio. The views expressed in Voices of the Mat-Su do not represent the views of Big Cabbage Radio or the Mat-Su Health Foundation. Comments or questions about this show may be sent to voices@bigcabbageradio.org.